Revenue Committee Agenda, January 20th, 1981, 1:30 p.m. in hearing room 137 of the State Capitol Building. Committee Rules, Committee Work Plan, Orientation, Property Tax, Jim Scherzinger, Economist, Legislative Revenue Office. This is Take One, Side A.
We'll note the members present. First item on our agenda today is the adoption of rules. You have a copy in your
packet. Move the approval.
Okay. Are there any questions on the rules? Okay, the motion is that we adopt the rules as printed before the committee. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion's adopted. The rules. The rest of the agenda for this week will be comprised of basically orientation, broken down by subject or fields of study in the different areas of revenue. And we're going to talk about the work plan, and Rich is going to discuss that, and there are some implications, constitutional implications, which mean revenue raising measures must originate in the House, which means this committee must coordinate its schedule with the House so that we get a passing or a flow of legislation, and there will be some bills we can consider prior to receiving things from the House. But the major revenue bills that are going to raise revenue, if we're going to pass any legislation, will originate over there. And somewhat to my consternation, they have said they're not going to start considering those major bills until the middle of April of this year. And so, Rich, with that, why don't you just go ahead and talk a little bit about the work plan?
You know, normally, the House and Senate Revenue Committees both set up work calendars, and the calendars really are organized around specific fields of taxation or school finance, so that you try to deal with, as an example, the property tax all as a chunk, and so you can look at all the bills that you have in the property tax area, decide what kinds of changes you want to make to the property tax system, if any, what kind of administrative changes, what kind of exemptions, what kind of levy process changes you want to make there. And the same thing goes for the other areas, the inheritance and gift, personal income tax, or school finance. Normally what we do is try to work up a calendar based on those subject areas that are germane to the committee, and then develop a calendar where the House deals with that subject matter first, then the material, when they're through with it, the material crosses, all of the bills that they have under their jurisdiction cross, they come to the Senate, and then the Senate's able to deal with them with, in effect, a lag on when the House begins that subject area. In dealing then with the House committee last week and them establishing their calendar, their work plan, that's what the document you have in your folder is. It lays out the House Revenue Committee's work plan. They plan in their study to deal with the property tax system, then the inheritance and gift, then the personal income tax, then corporate excise tax, then the highway fund, then a variety of miscellaneous revenue bills they'll have, and they plan to do those study areas before the middle of April. Then they plan on beginning approximately in the middle of April, having hearings on the governor's tax increase proposals as a study topic. Then they hope to conclude that in the early part of May and take any action they're going to on those measures. Basically, their perspective is, in the meantime, Ways and Means will have an opportunity to go through the governor's budget, to analyze it carefully and decide to what extent any revenue-raising matters are really needed. And then also, by around the early part of May, you will get the final revenue forecast from the executive department. By putting those two pieces of information together, then the committee can come to a conclusion on what tax increases they think are needed. then based on that, they'll act on a tax package. If they either vote one out or not vote one out, or vote part of one out, or whatever. And then also what sort of precipitates after that is what they're going to do in school finance. Because again, this committee and that committee will have jurisdiction over the formula, any changes you make in the distribution of the state aid formula. And finally, what you're going to do in tax relief, or in conjunction with that, what you're going to do with tax relief, both the HARP plan and the 30% plan. And then they have placed after that energy and timber taxation as the last two items. So that what that normally means is that if they're going to start the property tax study next week and they're going to take 3 weeks, that maybe about the second week you'd start getting bills of that 3 week period, you'd start getting bills from their study of the property tax. In the meantime, and that you can still look at their whole schedule with that kind of delay in mind. In the meantime, you have a variety of bills, I think maybe 10 to 12 bills, primarily administrative bills, no revenue raising bills, that were introduced on the Senate side. So you do have the opportunity to deal with orientation initially, and at least staff thinks it's a good idea that you take a little time to sit down and think through the tax law again, have the staff present, here's the way the property tax operates, here's the latest data on the property tax, to walk you through the school finance distribution system, to try to ground you in some basic facts so you're ready as those bills hit you to fit them into that theory or fit them into the mechanics of the operation there. And then after that initial orientation, you'd be ready to start hitting the sort of miscellaneous administrative bills that you do have on the Senate side now.
Okay. Are there questions about work by Senator Hammond?
Mr. Chairman, would it be your thought that this committee could go ahead and act on Chapter 530 independently of the House action? Possible review of changes of those statutes?
Yeah, I think we could. We could look at that area separate from them, yes.
That's extreme value.
Is there legislation in? Is there legislation in dealing with it?
No. During the I had a task force that dealt with it, and also the interim committee dealt with it. But there's litigation, and there's also a variety of opinions about whether 530 ought to be reviewed. I'm particularly interested in. We ought to be interested in soon because enormous sums of money is going to be produced by state-owned timberlands with
that
distribution.
530 deals
county.
With the distribution formula of the revenue receipts from state forest lands.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tillamook County alone is projected to be in for something like $2 billion in a relatively short period of time. And we better deal with it before that kind of money starts coming in.
Well, but of course, once the projection's made, it doesn't matter whether you deal with it after they got the cash or before. It's going to be a very sensitive area. It always has been. And if the history of that chapter of law is so scrambled and mixed that you can see that it was a very pressurized atmosphere in which the laws were developed and put together, because obviously there are big winners and big losers in a contest for those funds. But I think we can look at that.
Sure. Senator Day.
What has been your discussion with the chairman of the House Revenue Committee? What have you been able to glean from that? I share with you a little bit concern of delay.
I find that both the speaker and the chairman of that committee feel that until people have a sense of where we are budgetarily, in essence, until the members of the House, from their perspective, can see that there is a need for revenue, that they're not going to do anything about revenue. And I agree with that. I understand that. My point back to them, and the counterpoint, is that if these things do not shake down together, it's possible that they never will, or
perhaps late August, they will.
Yeah, we preclude our opportunity to really look at it.
And to look at options to those programs as well. And that, my belief is that the budget needs to shake down together, both sides of it. And that members have to be getting that sense at the same time that if I'm going to vote for this spending, I may have to vote for some revenue. And to get those 16 votes about the same time is essential. And to do it otherwise, you pick up the enemies of those programs, who then start fighting those programs by fighting your revenue side, and vice versa. And I just don't want to get into that that kind of...
Have you thought how we could operate somewhat independently to start studying that?
Possibly that we could act independently without having possession of the bills, of looking into them from simply a study and having briefings on them. I would like, however, if we can work something out with them,
sure,
to do it that way, as opposed to us acting almost in a peremptory fashion and causing hard feelings. And so I think we'll have to look at it over the next couple of weeks and see if we cannot persuade to look at it.
Even if we can study and take a look at the governor's revenue producing package and have a kind of understanding, yes, of the mechanics, I think it'd be helpful. But it just strikes me, we just one vantage point, we are sitting here without really not knowing what the expenditure level is going to be. There's some concern that revenue projections will be reduced, and the budget indeed has holes in it, but that is under financed. If we're looking at the governor's proposal, it's $241 million in new tax revenue. If that budget is underestimated between $40 and $45 million, I think some of those people, it's $285 million, and if the projections are reduced by another $100 million, which some are predicting, that's $380 million shortfall, and it's going to take more than just a little, as you say. We could be here in July and August still reviewing those, and I just have some major concern that hopefully we can arrive at some what we think is a good expenditure level, and then try to diagnose what's the possible in revenue raising, because that isn't the greatest subject right now that our constituents are interested in. I just share that with you. I have some real concern of that delay, but maybe you can. I want to share that with you anyway, and I don't know how the rest feel, but I feel very uneasy having about 3 months get away from us without really doing our homework. At least we're prepared, and we don't have to start cold turkey. I'm sure that'd be helpful to new members.
Senator Murrow?
Well, I have some very serious concerns, and I also am a little bit confused by this House Revenue Committee schedule here. According to this schedule, they're going to look at corporate excise tax, and they're going to look at personal income tax before April the 15th. But they're not going to look at the governor's proposed tax package, which includes a corporate excise tax increase, which includes a personal income tax increase, and so forth.
They're not looking at any revenue-raising matters till after April 15th.
Well, now, what are they doing then here on personal income tax and corporate excise tax, just looking at what they are now and not dealing with any of the bills?
They will deal with a variety, as I understand it, administrative bills. They'll look at the federal tax differences, federal tax law differences. They'll look at the other bills that have been introduced, but I don't think they'll be kicking out. Their intent is not to kick out anything that raises revenue or that cuts revenue in dealing with those subject matters before the middle of April.
Okay, well.
And any of those bills that they want to kick out separate from the governor's program, they would deal with after that point in time.
With that in mind, I would have to concur very strongly with the comments of Senator Day. I would like to see this committee review options in each one of these tax areas, each one of these revenue areas, look at options so that when we do get the final revenue projections, or the nothing's final, the later revenue projections in late April or May, early May, sometime there, when we do get those revenue projections, then we'll be ready to work very quickly, simply plug in one of the options that we've already reviewed and that we're already familiar with.
Chairman, and have you talked to Ways and Means or any of the leadership? Is there any sentiment, serious sentiment, for producing a solid one-year budget with plans to deliberately come back and take another look in view of recent experience?
think there are people who have fostered that, and that it has been discussed, and will may be the case even if we try to put together a two-year budget. I think some, including myself, feel strongly that we should try to design a two-year budget, even if we know, in fact, we're going to have to come back. Because I think there is some danger with, in essence, putting part of the pain off until the last year of a biennium, and that we need to look at the resources as best we can now and to spread that, even though we know we may come back depending on later revenue forecasts and have reinstatement of some cuts, perhaps, or maybe cutting more, as we had to do before. But the governor would have to go back, and his agencies would have to go back at this point and completely recapitulate the budgetary process to bring to us that kind of information. And that would take, I think, I don't know, how long would that take, Rich?
It would take a long time to actually physically break every budget into an annual budget. It would take,
I think, we've
had agencies working almost a year now on their budgets.
But it is unusual. We've appropriated one year at a time and come back to re-examine it, but we have actually done that. But I think you're right. I think we may be in a situation where we may jolly well not find it very wise to just walk away from here, because I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but I'm not very comfortable with the emergency board deciding that, particularly this type of crunch.
I wonder, Mr. Chairman, if
it
wouldn't be possible at some stage, I know we'll be doing studying too, but to hear from the governor and to hear a presentation of his particular proposals.
Well, I think in the discussion you heard here, I think that you know that I'm concerned about the delay, that and I can pass on the fact that Senator Fadley's concerned about the delay. And again, I think hopefully the consensus here is to try to work with the House and the leadership and expressing our concerns about this delay, and if that fails, to say that the Senate is not going to be put in a position of receiving a series of plans in June, maybe late June, and then being asked to look at options at that time, that we would prefer to look at those proposals and alternatives to those proposals and options now. Not to enact them, not to pass them out, but to be looking at them so that we can act with some dispatch at the time and with the intelligence.
So if I read you correctly, Mr. Chairman, you're saying, yes, indeed, we will look at all of these things and study them.
Yes.
And we'll start right away.
And that isn't an affront to the House.
No.
That's just for our edification, yes, really.
Right,
that's
sure.
What you're talking
about. We can act first, but we can know as much as they do.
What I do not want to do is to get into a verbal battle with them in the press or otherwise. I don't think that helps anything. And if so, I do want to work with them if we can, instead of appearing to be going over their heads.
But we'll have to make a lot of very serious decisions. And
yes.
We have a lot of knowledge and we need to start now.
Which includes
yes, I think we could ask the governor to address the one-year concept to see where his people would come from on that.
Yeah, we'll be very excited about that.
Yeah. Okay, are there other questions about the work plan? Okay, is Jim ready to start on the property tax? Our first area that we're going to look at is basically in following the field of study breakdown as proposed by this. No, I asked him, he said no.
Would it be possible to adopt a two-year budget, but it'd be appropriate the first year?
Yeah.
Or you'd be appropriated.
Oh, let's come back and change it.
Change or you appropriated. Put it all over. Well, I think it would make some more sense if we're going to have to come back anyway to schedule it. So to do it as special sessions like we have.
No, that's what I think.
Plus, if you do cramp, try to cramp everything into one, you change the players out here who are trying to influence this process. And you start, in part, betting on the come. And what we have to bet on right now is the system that we have, which is a two-year forecasting mechanism. That's very dangerous if you then disregard that and start betting that certain things surely will happen before we come back. That just makes me very, very uneasy in these times.
We'll follow in from this information, Mr. Chairman, from the agency.
Yes. Okay. What I propose, and Jim, I hope you're listening, because what I want to ask the members to do, for the most part, is to write their questions down. If a question comes to mind that does not detract from you following the process, that is, if you have a policy question or something like that, if we could hold them until the presentation is over so that the members who did not have that particular question can continue to follow the item at hand. But if you're having trouble with a formula or something, then interruptions are, I think, in order. But if it's to get off on a tangent, let's try to restrain ourselves. And another thing we'll try to do is to restrain these sessions to an hour, hour and 10 minutes, and no more, so that we can try to remember what we've been hit with. And to also remember that we're trying to get an overview and not become PhDs in the subject or work on bills right now. Some of us remember bills that have gone through that in this area, and instead of getting back and saying, hey, well, how about that concept, to try to just get an overview of the structure and the information that's available to us when we get to those bills.
Mr. Chairman, is it possible for some of the audience who want to see this?
Sure, if they can just move up. We can move the board around the pillar, perhaps.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm sure I have to change that one.
No.
Is it your intention, at least for a time, to meet at 1:30 rather than 1 regularly?
I think for this week. Yes.
Okay.
Your committee, the way you schedule it in the book, is 1:30.
Yeah. And not on Friday.
And not on Friday. Yes. Okay.
No meeting this Friday.
That means we probably all have 3 o'clock meeting scheduled. Okay, Jim.
He was directing that stuff about not wanting to become a PhD on this committee.
Yes.
Hope you got to get the PhD.
I was wondering that.
That's right. We got
two of them.
Too many of them. Okay, go ahead.
No matter how sophisticated the audience, when we talk about the property tax, I'd like to start with this simple diagram on the board, because that says a lot about it. Says a lot about the property tax. You can derive a lot of the basics about the property tax from that and this very simple equations. First of all, you take a district levy determined by the voters, et cetera, et cetera. Divide that by the total value in the district to get a tax rate. And secondly, you take that, once that tax rate is determined, you take a tax rate, multiply it by an individual's value, and you get an individual's taxes. The first thing you can derive from that is that these two are independent. District levy is determined by one process, and that process is almost entirely independent of the determination of the total value of that district. Now, there are always exceptions to this, but they're minor. We'll get to those later. But The main thing is that the district levy is independent of the value of the district. You have one process here, another process here. Now, from that you can derive a number of other things, like what's the effect of an exemption that you grant. Well, the effect of an exemption is to decrease the total value of the district. It doesn't do anything to the levy, it just decreases the value. Decrease the value, increase the tax rate. Increases the tax rate, anybody who's still paying, in other words, it's not exempt. Higher tax rate, same value, pays more tax. So the effect of an exemption is that you shift the burden amongst the people that are still left. No effect on the left. Another thing you can derive from that is what's the effect of, say, if your value doubles, your individual value doubles, and the total value doubles. In other words, your value goes up the same as everybody else. Well, the total value doubles, tax rate falls in half, tax rate's in half, individual value doubles, so the net effect is zero, assuming there's no change in the levy. So if you have a double value and the total value doubles, in other words, your value going up the same as everybody else, no effect on your tax. On the other hand, what's the effect of what's the effect if your value goes up but less than the total value as a percentage? Say the total value goes up, doubles, and your value goes up by 20%. Then the tax rate falls in half, your value doubles, or your value goes up 20%. Tax rate in half, your value up 20%, your taxes go down. Or if you go up faster than the average, then your taxes go up. All that can be gleaned right from this basic diagram. And I think you understand that.
Okay, questions on that diagram? That sounds awfully simple, but we've had members of the legislature testify before this committee and didn't understand that. Senator Hamm?
You could get every property taxpayer in the state to understand that diagram and probably eliminate 90% of the problem.
Don't worry about that day, because you and I won't see it.
Don't bet on it.
Just, that's another thing I think is important for this committee to understand, is the lack of understanding out there. And we can kind of keep that in our, I forget it. I really do. You know, we get so close to these issues that pretty soon we assume that everybody understands what a good deal we're giving them. And what you find out is that they got a better deal, but they don't believe it. And they think you've done it to them again, even though you've tried to improve it for them. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, to continue on that point, Richard Munn, in one of his earlier presentations, made the comment that Oregon's tax system is number one on the progressivity chart, and Washington's is number 50 on the progressivity chart, and yet the degree of taxpayer concern, rebellion, is approximately the same in both states.
That's right. Okay, Jim.
Okay, from this point, given the independence of these two, you can divide almost the field of property tax into two separate fields almost. One, the determination of the levy, and two, the determination of value. So I'm going to start with levy. And somebody's already written something. You don't want to know what's going on. So starting with the levy, first of all, what do you need to levy a property tax? Well, the first thing, you need two things under the local budget law. And one of these is something that you may know, but a lot of people, another thing a lot of people don't know, you need an adopted budget. And there's a whole body of law called the local budget law that tells the district what they have to go through to get a budget adopted. They have to have hearings, they have to have a budget committee, they have to go through a whole formal process of adopting a budget that shows what they're going to spend the money on. So the first thing you need is an adopted budget that says what you're going to spend the money on. Second thing you need is approval of the voters for the levy. We need two things.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Monroe.
Unless, of course, they have a tax base which would encompass the entire amount of the local budget.
Well, we're saying that they got the voter approval a long time ago. They had to have voter approval at some point for that levy. It might have been 20, 50 years ago. You don't know. It had to be approved. All right, so that's the two things you need, voter approval and your adopted budget. Then, as for levies, what types of levies are there? Well, first of all, I like to divide it this way. permanent levying authority. All right, the most common example of that is tax base. So a tax base. The tax base is permanent levying authority. Once your tax base is approved, you can levy that. In fact, you can increase it at 6% a year for every year thereafter, as long as you can continue to levy it. So permanent levying authority. This is the most common kind. Tax base can only be adopted at a new one, at a primary or a general election. And second, there are some sort of holdover levies that are still around. You see them in cities. You can't get new ones, but call them continuing levies. And those are old rate-based levies that exist. And I bring them up mainly because in tax plan revisions, you're going to have to deal with what they're going to do about these continuing levies and how they work on the AV ballot funding and all that. Because when the tax plan went through, nobody thought about these. In fact, they didn't think about any kind of serial levy. So that's going to be something you're going to have to really understand what these levies are to understand what we did with them. This year, because I think I found in trying to present this that it works best to start right off with what you did last session, two classes of property. It's almost easier to explain things if you begin right with that. Two classes of property, homestead, homesteads are owner-occupied personal residences, and all other is all other. So beginning with that.
Excuse me. Also included in a homestead is the land necessary for that residence.
Right.
Isn't that true?
Right.
Not necessarily necessary for the residence. It's up to an acre, isn't it?
Well, it's up to the acre or the minimum
zone
lot size.
Okay. So it is.
Even then, it's not that.
Yeah.
If you've got 30 acres, the minimum is 20, so you can't split off the other ends. Then you get the whole 30. So
it is, then Senator Monroe's statement was truly accurate. It is the amount of land necessary for the house. There are some exceptions to that, though, isn't there? You go out on EFU land, where you have a 40-acre minimum lot size, they don't get the 40 acres.
No, if you're on a special assessment, that land will not qualify for
homestead payment. So in the case of farmland, it's up to an acre, is it not, or something like
that?
Well,
it depends. If the farmer doesn't want to put that on the farm deferral, then they can take the whole 40 acres if that's minimum lot size, I think. I don't know. I presume. I just know a farmer would never want to do that.
No, he'd be much better off under the special.
Well, if he could divide it, he might not. If he could, he still would be better off under the special.
If he can divide it, then it must not have a minimum 40-acre lot size.
But if he can divide it into one 40-acre parcel from the rest of his farm, take the 30% on that 40 acres, but it still wouldn't pay
him. It wouldn't pay him to do that. He's much better off on the farm.
Tax deferral. In an urban area such as I represent, if a person owns a home and owns the vacant lot next door, which is zoned for another home, but it's vacant. They can't take that vacant lot next door. They can't take the 30% on it. They can only take the 30% on their home and on the lot that it's sitting on.
Because they can't divide it.
And a lot of people scream about that. Yeah. Hey, I got to pay full taxes on that lot next door. Yeah. Yep, that's right. You do.
Okay, so given that everything's set, you got everything into two classes of property. Second major rule, everything is at a percent, or assessed at a percent of value, percent of true cash value. And I think it's, at this point, easiest to sort of differentiate three terms: assessed value, true cash value, market value. Assessed value is the value that you use for determination of the tax. Apply the tax rate to it. Assessed value is equal to some percentage of true cash value. All right, it's one percentage if you're a homestead, a different percentage if you're not a homestead. But in any case, assessed value is the value you apply the rate to for determination of the tax, is equal to some fixed percentage of the true cash value. True cash value and market value often are used interchangeably, but I think now that we have this separate concept assessed, it's easy to sort of keep things, keep them separate in some ways. First of all, we use true cash value often when it's not market value. So we'll say true cash value for farm use, or true cash value for open space use. So there's a lot of special assessments. And we'll call the true cash value in a special use as its true cash value. And that's the way the law reads. That's not what you would sell it for if you went out into the open market necessarily. So just keep in mind,
Senator McFarland.
Who arrives at that?
County assessor, in most cases.
That's whatever true cash value is.
Right. The you, through your statutes, tell a county assessor how to value property, whether it's going to be at market value, or it's going to be at a true cash value in a special use, or whether you can't use a particular method, or whether that property is exempt. And so you might say that farmland that meets certain qualifications has to be valued at, not at market value, but at true cash value for farm use. And not true cash value in any use. And so the law always deals and tries to deal with true cash value and assessed value.
Senator Monroe.
Okay, but except in those cases where there's a special use, isn't it true that true cash right. value is supposed to equal market value?
The general rule is that true cash value is all. Used to be before this assessment system that all property was valued at true cash value, which was the same as market value. Yeah. Except now when you have these special assessments. So now I think it helps to keep it straight in your own mind, now that we've got three different terms, to think of assessed value as being the value that the rate is applied to. True cash value is the value that the assessor says that property is worth for whatever reason. And market value is what it would sell for. The term that's used in the law is true cash, and very rarely is it market. So, and that just keeps thinking straight as things get more complicated.
So,
Mr. Trump,
yeah, if you had property in which you were trending the true cash value, it might not be the same as market, because if you really kept up with the market, it might be.
That could be another example.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Payne.
Have you done a review of where we are in our cycle? Most counties in a six-year cycle are where we at?
We haven't.
I'd kind of like to know where that is. I know in Marion County's case, because of the financial situation, we are at 8, maybe even 9, and they're trending it. And we're most concerned. We worked hard in the 60s to get the six-year cycle. I don't know whether there's a way to do it, but I can't believe that the Revenue Department couldn't produce that rather rapidly and give us a status on the county districts.
Oh, I'm sure that there are more than one county that's behind now.
Oh, I'm sure that's right.
So yeah. The law still says 6 years.
That's right.
So unless there are explanation points behind.
This is a new point. I wasn't aware that counties were allowed to be behind. What happens to them when they get behind?
They get trended.
Well, they trend during the, between year one and year six of the six-year cycle, they trend. I understand that. I understand how trending works. But my point is, when a county violates the law by going beyond that 6 years, what happens to that county?
Take away the 30%.
No, is there any?
The department has the authority to go in and do it and do the evaluation and charge the county.
Have they ever done that?
Reluctant to do that.
They have never done that.
It ultimately gets down.
I've only been around 2 years, so.
It ultimately gets down to the to this question. The state requires the county to perform a service. What happens if the county will not budget the money to perform the service? That's the bottom line question. The state goes in, sends them a bill. What if they won't pay the bill? Then do you, do you jail the county commissioners? Do you?
That's a thought.
Well, we've had some thoughts down here on that.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Right here, there are some thoughts given.
But, you know, but you said that the state requires the county to perform a service, namely auditing.
No, assessment.
Assessing. But the purpose, of the assessment is for county and local property taxes. The state has no property tax.
Don't say that too loud, or the counties are going to come back and say, then get out of our assessment procedure. Yeah, it's a local, but yet we set the law for
how we mandate how assessment shall be done.
Yes, and how levies shall be raised. And
right. Which districts and the levy.
Yes.
Right, I understand that. But it seems to me that it's in the, it's, all we'd have to do is pass a law saying that unless your assessments are up to date on the 6-year cycle, you can't collect any money, and they'd get up to date real quick.
Yeah, but where they would get the money to do that might surprise you too.
Let me give you a fact situation. Here in Marion County, we're $5 million. We have gone out levies and a tax base and turn to. We are behind. The reason I asked the question, I'd like to know where we are in this. The net result is what revenue has put the arm on them, and they put a heavier trend on to try to keep within the tolerance of percentage level. But what's unfair about that is that when you trend it, you aren't really looking at and eyeballing those property. People are getting property evaluations that are out of sync, and then you go down to the equalization. If most people don't even know how to go to the Board of Equalization that it exists, and it's easier said than done. I think it's correct, and I think we put that six or we were up to date, I think, until about 3 years ago. We were on a pretty good cycle other than Multnomah County. We ran into problems with them from time to time. But we had a tax revolt in 1967 because we put the arm of the assessor up at Multnomah County and told him to get cracking because he's one who was dragging his feet. And we just had literally the we had the Proposition 13 during that period.
I think they're still behind in Multnomah County from the data I saw.
But it would be interesting, really, to look at this situation to see what we're getting into. But I don't know what you do if they simply have tried for the money. They're busting their apples to try to do it, and they can't do it. What's the alternative? You know, really difficult.
That's right. It is. It's the whole role of the assessor. He's or she is simply a unwanted stepchild of two governments.
Mm-hmm.
The state tells them what to do, the county pays them. And some counties are almost to the point of not paying them, and it's even one of them went so far as to quit being an assessor and run for the legislature. Now, something's wrong with that kind of a system to leave a $30,000 a year job to take this. Something's really wrong with the system. But he won. People, that shows you how bad they dislike assessors.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jernstedt.
Are there any cases in the state because of the recession, the attrition we're in, where the assessed value and so-called true cash value is getting ahead of market value?
I wouldn't say that it's getting ahead of market necessarily. It could be. We just wouldn't have the data to prove it, because the best data you've got on the value of property is what the assessor's gathering.
It's market value.
Right. Or is what the they do the ratio studies, and I think the ratio studies, if Terry just went to a meeting today, where they actually do look at sales of property, and they're showing roughly maybe an 8% increase in market value this year for the trending or for the looking at seeing whether the counties are all the way up to 100% on true cash value. So it appears that values are still rising. The sales data show that.
The appreciated value, though, is slowing down. The
right.
Rate
I'm,
of growth.
I'm getting complaints right. that this is happening. The assessed value is higher than the
mark.
They're certainly getting closer, and in some cases, I'm sure that's probably true. And it's not necessarily because the average assessment level is so high, but maybe because they're the equity within the county, because they're not keeping up, just as Senator Day was saying, if they're not keeping up with their reappraisal cycle, then a particular house might be over its value or another is under, so that the average is about right. So that's the equity within the county that Senator Day was talking about.
Just a few months ago, I had some constituents call who had over 100% increase in the value of their property, but they informed me at the time they still would not sell their property for that assessed value. And so I don't know of anybody who's reduced values in any county. I don't know of any insurance company which is projecting replacement cost and, in essence, the market value, who is decreasing or has stopped increasing in the inflation factor on homeowners insurance. So I know of no indicator other than, as I leaf through the back page of the newspaper, it looks like the sales price of homes is down from what it was, but still the average home in Multnomah County was valued at right at $30,000, wasn't it? I can't remember what the average was, but I was really surprised to see that last session, that it was in the $30,000 range, plus or minus. It may have been $35,000, but it was not what you would expect it to be, which means that there are some of them out there at 50 and some of them out there at 20.
Yeah.
And under. So and a lot of them at that. So I don't know. Some counties may be in different positions.
What you're saying is not inconsistent. The average level might be very much close to market, but that doesn't mean that one house might be too high and the other one too low.
And they have an appeals process too.
That's the equity within the system that you get out of the
reappraisal. Of course, what you were faced with 2 years ago was this accelerated appreciated value of housing value, because you move in a house at appreciated value, you wouldn't sell it for what you paid for the day you walked in, because appreciated value was upwards.
Jim, how much longer will your presentation take?
Well, it's not that much longer.
We have about 5 minutes.
Depends on how much we gab.
Yes, we're guilty of it. It's his fault. It's our fault.
Okay, on the value end of it, one other main thing I wanted to go over, the two brief things, was the 5% assessment limit. And if you remember last session, you passed legislation that restricted the growth in average assessed values within each one of these classes, 5%. Right, and what you do there is you say, well, let's see, if we let it grow at true cash, what would it be? And then we say, well, what do we have to reduce it by to get it down to the 5% assessment limit? And that fraction that you reduce it by is called the statewide ratio within each class. And the ratio turned out to be 84.2% for homesteads and 87.6% for all other property. So in other words, the average increase in the homestead property in true cash value was higher than the all other, so you had to reduce it more to get it down to 5%.
I'm a little confused on
Senator Trump.
The 5% is 5% of what?
It's 5% growth in assessed value.
Total assessed value for the entire state?
For the entire state within each class.
Within each class. The entire
state.
Not
counting new construction.
Not counting new construction in each class. That's, and you will only allow it to grow by 5%. But we do determine how much it does grow, and then we work this formula out, and that formula would be the percentage that the 5% would be of what it actually grows. Is that
right? Right. That's the percentage of the true cash value that you put on the roll as assessed value to guarantee that the average assessment growth is only 5%.
If you took 84.2 of all individual parcels and figured out what the total would be, that would be the 5%.
Right.
It would allow for the 5% and no more.
Right, after you took out the new construction.
Yeah.
Senator Monroe.
So just to clarify, that's 15.8% below 100, so that means that homesteads went up by 20.8%.
Well, it doesn't quite work that way. It's, it because it's multiplicative instead of.
Yeah, okay,
so
but
it's
approximately.
I think it's about 24 versus 19.
19 for all other?
19 for all other and 24 for the.
Okay. If that system did anything that was good, and I say if, it did stop that shift, and you see the magnitude of that shift, which was roughly 1% per year over the last 10 years, that is, homeowners were paying 10% more after 10 years of the total property tax burden than the other all other class of property. This tends to stabilize that at what where they were. It didn't roll it back or anything, but it tends to stabilize that so that shift is
wait
not
a minute.
Occurring.
Well,
Senator McFarland?
Yes, I still, I don't mean to be dense, but go through that again. If you're allowed to raise it 5% a year, so how did you arrive at that 84.2?
Okay, I hope this works out. This is the homestead class increase.
But how do you know that?
That they did through a ratio study. So they found what the average increase in homestead property was from 1 year to the next. So it's all part of the assessment process.
This is the true cash value.
True cash value, that's right.
All right.
So that's what true cash value would have grown were it not for this limit.
All right.
So they go out and they appraise all this property at true cash value. They say, the average is 24%. So then you take 1.24, that's 24%, and you got to find out what you have to multiply by to get 1.05, which is a 5% increase.
Which
is all you can have, and it turns out it should be about 84.2.
Right. Okay, now I understand. Thank
okay,
you.
I think this is like 1.246.
But it doesn't mean that an individual property would be limited always to 5%.
Yes, that was the complaint that people have called me about the 100% increase.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, I believe in Lynn
County.
Tell me
you're behind.
I believe in Lynn County this year our average was a 2% decrease in the assessed value for purposes of taxation countywide. It was actually a decrease. Yes, because of the fact that they grew, that the market value grew at a lesser rate than other counties around the state. And as a consequence of that, when you factor it down, instead of being at zero growth, we actually went beneath it because we only grew, say, 10% when the rest of the state was growing at 20%, and so we actually got a negative figure. And the rates go up, yes.
Okay,
we have to break it up. Were you just going to summarize?
Well, all I was going to say was this amounts to about $11 million in taxes this year.
Wait.
Stop the shift of about $11 million in taxes.
Okay, stop the shift. How much did the property tax raise in the is projected to raise in the biennium?
In 80-81, the levies were almost $1.2 billion.
Okay. Now, isn't it true that about the last biennium, the income tax and the property tax in Oregon crossed and raised roughly the same amount of revenue in the two-year period? As I recall, that was true about two.
Right, if you add in the corporate, yes.
Yes. About so right. that when you get the letter from your constituent that says, just abolish the property tax and slightly increase the income tax, you can write back and say that slight increase means doubling it.
Yes.
In order to provide the same amount of money.
One thing, when you say $1.2 billion, are you counting the 30% relief?
I'm not reducing it by the 30%.
All right, so that's
the total levy, yes.
All right,
I'm not
we
reducing
substituted, if we took 30% off, that's what we actually collected.
Well, not quite 30, because it's 30% of
okay,
the homestead.
Okay, I appreciate that. Okay.
Here's the data right here.
Are you saying that this 5% assessment
40%
stops
the
shift from one kind of property to another or slows the shift?
It pretty much stops it. If there's a difference in new construction, then it's going to have a marginal effect. Or if they make a mistake in the ratio study, it's going to have an effect.
But the point is, from those biennium that I'm talking about, there was no 30% program at that time.
Yeah, that's right.
But there was a HARP program and some other programs where income tax money was.
Yeah, I think it's
1.05 divided by 1.46.
Okay, 1:30 tomorrow. Senator Day will be presiding. I have to be gone.